And so Methodists have for centuries, really, operated out of this concept that on the essentials, meaning doctrine, we ought to have unity. On the non-essentials, of which this is one of them, we ought to have a little bit of liberty. But in all things, we ought to have charity, right? This love. And so I think for me, there's also a sense of peace that we've come to some sense of here's who we are, and no longer are we going to let a non-essential issue direct the entirety of the General Conference.
Thank you for listening to the Life Plus God podcast. My name is Alyssa Robinson. I'm your host. And today I am with three beloved pastors, Reverend Daniel Humbert, Reverend Karen Kraska, and Reverend Gracie Millard. Thank y'all so much for being here. And today we're answering the question, what's new in the United Methodist Church?
Is there anything new?
Yeah, there's much.
Oh.
So as some of y'all, my pastor at Oaklawn calls them metho nerds. Some of the Methodist nerds out there might have been following along with everything that has been unfolding in General Conference over the last 10 days and seeing there's a lot of new. There's a lot of new experiences, new philosophies that are being adopted in the United Methodist Church. And we're going to talk through some of those. And I want to give y'all a heads up of all of the things that we're going to talk about in this episode today. What y'all might not know is that in General Conference, which actually, before I get into this, Daniel, could you give us an overview of what General Conference is and why we do it?
Yeah, it is the highest level of the United Methodist denomination. It typically happens once every 4 years. It's the only organization, the General Conference, that can speak on behalf of the whole church. The General Conference is the one that sets policy and procedure, helps establish the processes that are contained within our Book of Discipline. And our Book of Discipline has kind of both our doctrinal standards, which are unchangeable, and then process and procedure that is changeable. And that's what the General Conference deals with. And it's full of elected delegates, half clergy and half laity, that have been elected by the previous annual conferences, the local judicatory bodies. And it's a global event. So United Methodists from all over the world come together. There's typically up to 1,000 delegates. I think this year there were 860 some odd. But anyway, it's that organization, and it only happens once every 4 years, except on special occasions.
Mm. And it's a big deal, guys. There's a lot that is covered in those 10 days. They are literally going all day, every day, 10 days. And so what that means is there were more than 1,000 petitions considered over 10 days. Mm. I'm not going to have you sit through 1,000 petitions and the changes that came out of those. We're going to hit broad strokes. Okay. So here are the, and some of them you might have seen straight out of the headlines already. So we're going to talk about, first, we're going to talk about the changes to the Book of Discipline, specifically around human sexuality. Then we're going to talk about the revised social principles. We're going to talk about the adoption of regionalization. We're going to talk about some changes for clergy and some changes around budget. So for each of these things, we're going to define what it is. You might be like, I have never heard of social principles. What the heck is that? And what does it mean? We're going to talk about it. We're going to talk about what has changed, what hasn't changed, and what it means for the local church at the local level. What are we adopting? What is changing for us? Are we going to need to start doing things differently? So let's dive in to maybe the most controversial topic for the past 40 years.
You don't want to hold that till the very end.
No. My journalism training will not allow it. Do not bury the lead.
Wow, okay.
So we're going to talk about the Book of Discipline. What is the Book of Discipline and how is it different from our doctrine?
Well, it's not different. First of all, it contains our doctrine. So, about a third of our Book of Discipline is our doctrine and our history, if you will. And that's unchangeable. The doctrine is unchangeable. There are what are known as restrictive rules. And those restrictive rules say that our articles of religion, our confession of faith, and our general rules, which are three of five components that make up our doctrine. The other are Wesley's notes and his sermons on several occasions. Those will never change, obviously, because they're established, right? But the restrictive rules say none of the articles of religion or confession of faith or the general rules can ever be changed or, revoked or altered. So, I mean, it's very clear that can't change. But that's the first part of the Book of Discipline. And then the back sort of two-thirds or maybe even 75% is about policy, procedure, how we operate, how we conduct ourselves, clergy, local church, districts, annual conferences, general conference, trustees, all the committees, all of that stuff is what's in sort of the back half. And that's what general conference usually deals with and what most of those 1,000 petitions were all about is that stuff.
The big conversation, the biggest change in the Book of Discipline with this session of General Conference is the approach to human sexuality. Now, let me read to you the language that was previously in the Book of Discipline that has now been removed as a result of this General Conference. The language that was in there, it stated, the practice of homosexuality is incompatible with Christian teaching. Therefore, self-avowed practicing homosexuals are not to be certified as candidates, ordained as ministers, or appointed to serve in the United Methodist Church. So this language has been removed entirely. A little bit of history around this language in the Book of Discipline. It has not always been there. This language was added in 1972 to the Book of Discipline, and in 1984, it was made an actionable offense. So what does actionable offense mean? That means that you can be defrocked if you're practicing.
Charges can be brought up against you in the United Methodist Church, not like legal charges, but within the United Methodist judicial system, a clergy person, another clergy person or somebody in your congregation could bring a chargeable offense, could bring a charge against you.
And that charge could lead to your defrocking.
Yes.
Or disciplinary action of a different sort. Okay.
It was the first phrase, the practice of homosexuality is incompatible with Christian teaching. That phrase was added in 72 to the social principles, which aren't actionable. They're simply stances that the United Methodist Church takes on certain social issues.
Okay.
It was in 1984 that the latter part of that phrase was added, as you mentioned, as the actionable offense.
Mm-hmm. So I think, like I said, this has been removed entirely. It has not been replaced with new language. And I just want to hear some input from y'all of what does this mean to you personally? Is this something that was surprising to you? Like, what were some of the feelings around this language?
It's so supercharged. It's fraught with a lot of emotion, a lot of intensity, and I don't believe to a person that anyone that I've had discussions with wants to dishonor Scripture or the Bible. And I don't think we're here today to debate biblical text. However, I can say I am so excited that we found some resolution to this issue, because the entire time I've been ordained as a clergy person in the United Methodist Church, this seems to be at the forefront. I've been to general conferences, two of them. I've been to jurisdictional conferences. I've sat on a lot of boards and committees, and it seems like this has been our hot button issue. And to be honest, I am very fatigued talking about this issue. I'm ready to move forward. I'm ready for the United Methodist Church to truly open its arms, open its doors, open its hearts. And I believe that now that we have some freedom, that we can be the church more fully and with more integrity. And I believe that now our focus doesn't need to stay on this issue. Hmm. The United Methodist Church is doing so much good, not just in our conference or in our country, but in the world. And it seems like a total eclipse because of this issue. And we are one of, if not the last, major Protestant denominations to finally put this issue to rest. And there are options for those that agree or disagree. Removing this language doesn't mean that everyone is going to change their policy or procedure in local congregations. It just gives opportunity for different expressions of faith.
Yeah, I think for me, I have a similar reaction, right? So likewise, for my entire ministry, this seems to be the central issue. And it's not the central issue of the gospel, and it's not the central issue for most Christians. Now, is it an issue? Absolutely. But it's not a central issue, nor is it a doctrinal issue. And so Methodists have for centuries, really, operated out of this concept that on the essentials, meaning doctrine, we ought to have unity. On the non-essentials, of which this is one of them, we ought to have a little bit of liberty. But in all things, we ought to have charity, right? This love. And so I think for me, there's also a sense of peace that we've come to some sense of here's who we are, and we're, and no longer are we going to let a non-essential issue direct the entirety of the General Conference. No longer are we going to let something that is not unimportant, but isn't the most important thing we ought to talk about or deal with or approach, is no longer going to define us. We actually can make disciples of Jesus Christ. We can actually help engage people in living out their faith instead of getting stymied by something every single time we want to talk about the church. So I have a sense of relief.
I think I also experienced that relief. I've only been in ministry or gone through this whole process in the last 4 or 5 years. And I mean, because it's been part of y'all's experience the whole time, it's definitely been part of my experience the whole time where this has always been the front issue. I think I'm relieved for a lot of my colleagues and for people who didn't feel the freedom to go into ministry and do follow the calling that God called them to. And now I think just the removal of a restrictive language versus a mandate of a positive thing, it's just a removal of something. So it's not making anybody do anything. Instead, it's allowing freedom, freedom for any congregation, any local church as they see fit to ordain clergy, I mean, to move candidates through the process of ordination. It just, it opens up, I think, and allows more freedom. So I'm eager to see who will come forward and live out the calling to make disciples of Jesus Christ.
Yeah. Well, I'm a little more than relieved. I'm in jubilation. When I heard this news come through, I burst into tears because I go to a queer church. I have a senior pastor who's a lesbian and in a loving relationship with her wife. I have my best friends are a part of the queer community. And there has been this sense of being unloved by the church you commit your life to. On Sunday morning, this past Sunday, was the most celebratory, spirit-filled worship experience I've ever been a part of. For people to say, I'm living into my calling proudly, and I can no longer be punished for this. I mean, it was... I'm proud to call myself United Methodist, and like, we're doing this, we're trying. And so it was a all in moment for me of, you know, I'm proud to say I'm United Methodist after all of this.
I will agree with that. I'm very proud to be a United Methodist. I was proud before General Conference. I'm proud after General Conference because we're not afraid to wrestle with the tough issues. And I want to just be clear. I don't think there's winners and losers, so to speak. And that's the hard thing, is when someone gets a victory, it's for someone else, it's a deep loss. And I have friends on both sides of the issue that are very passionate, that are very godly, that are very scripturally informed and have a lot of integrity. So in my spirit, I hate that we can't please or appease, and I don't want to get into a debate on the authority of Scripture or the interpretation of Scripture or the Scriptures that deal with human sexuality. I believe that in the United Methodist Church, there is a wideness of expression. And to Daniel's point, we have we have doctrinal standards, but we don't all view Scripture the same way in the interpretation. And so I'm excited that now we're kind of unshackled. And for those that just cannot reconcile themselves, that there could even be the possibility that they would go into a United Methodist Church with a homosexual pastor or a queer or anything in the LGBTQ spectrum. If someone cannot wrap their head around that even the possibility that this has been discussed and debated and prayed over, there are options, and it's not United Methodist anymore.
I think that's what I appreciate most about what was done, was that restrictive language was removed and nothing new was put in its place. Mm-hmm. So it really does leave options, right? Mm-hmm. It really does say to any local congregation, if you're not ready for this, we're not forcing this on you.
Right.
If you're ready for this, like Oak Lawn or many other churches, man, go for it, right? Mm-hmm. To me, that's the beauty. And it is consequentially United Methodist, right? That it allows expression, that it allows for opportunity, and it allows for people and local congregations to proceed as they see fit.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk a little bit more about the local church and what this means for local churches. Since there was no new language added, no really ordinance put on from high, what does this removal of language mean for the local church in terms of performing marriages, ordaining? Well, actually, we haven't gotten to marriage yet, so that'll be under social principles. Sorry, everybody, I skipped ahead. Spoiler alerts. But in terms of having an ordained pastor who may be LGBTQIA.
Yeah, let me just correct one thing. The marriage stuff is not just in the social principles. In other words, that language has been removed too, and therefore clergy have the opportunity without being charged in performing those. And that's an actionable, had been an actionable offense as well.
So that was also removed from the Book of Discipline.
Correct.
This is also muddy for me. As I was doing my research, I'm like, what's the Book of Discipline? Yes. What's the social principle? What's the regionalization?
The social principles is a component of the Book of Discipline.
Okay. Yeah.
So for the local church, this becomes an issue of the Board of Trustees, really. That is to say, does new language need to be developed around a wedding policy? For some, it will. For others, it won't. It won't make any difference at all. And so the local church gets to make that choice, and it's not a clergy-made decision. It's a leadership decision, right? So in our case, it would be the Board of Trustees. Some churches may allow it to be their leadership board or administrative council or whatever their leadership body is, to just say, this, we now will do this, or we no longer, or we won't do this, right? It just, that's what, that's kind of how that's going to work. And the interesting part of that, what we clergy know that many regular church members don't know, is we have so few weddings at our church anymore. Mm-hmm. I've been here for a decade, and in that decade, I've only done 3 weddings on site in this building. Karen's done more, I know, but most of our weddings now are off-site on all kinds of venues that are off the campus of the church.
Well, and it used to be we had a wedding every weekend.
Right.
And
that has really, really changed. To Daniel's point, I think now what is more in style, so to speak, is the wedding venues with the chapel and then the party space or the reception space right there. So we are called to do weddings, but typically they are off-campus. I think last year, what did we have, 3?
Mm-hmm. If that on
if
site,
that on site,
yeah, they just don't happen on site much.
We
and
don't.
It has more
people
to do
aren't
with the
lining up.
Than
yes,
else.
It really
we
does.
We want a party, and we can't have that party here.
Right, right.
So does this mean? So okay, what does it mean for appointments to churches? Are churches going to be taking on LGBTQIA clergy, and do they have a decision on whether or not that person comes to their church?
Yeah, so that's always what's known as a consultative process, and I won't get too much in the weeds because One process is for deacons, which we'll talk about in a little bit, and one process is for elders. But the consultative process is basically, it involves three voices. One is the clergy. Hey, I want to stay or I want to go, or I'd like a new appointment or I don't, or whatever. The other is the staff parish relations committee, which is like the personnel committee of the church. They're the representatives of the body called, in this particular case, Treach Memorial United Methodist Church. So they represent the church about whether or not they want a pastor or a new pastor or whatever. And then what's known as the bishop and the cabinet, the Episcopal leader and the supervising minister.
From the annual conference.
Right, from the annual conference. And all three of those voices collectively make a decision that's based on all kinds of variables, some of which is giftedness and passion of the pastor, some of it's the context of the ministry in which the church exists, the mission field, and then some of it has to do with the needs of the annual conference. But it's a consultation, and the desire of the consultation is to meet the needs of all bodies, right? The local church, the serving pastor, even the annual conference. And so the goal is to try to make everybody happy. Right. That's the goal.
Well, and I think that's until I started working for the church, I didn't realize, you know, that I think the outsider perspective of appointments to a church is like the conference decides who goes where and you got to take them. No. You know, no matter what. And I didn't realize how much work and conversation goes into all of the decisions of who is appointed to what church, because they don't want to appoint someone to a church who will not be able to lead that church effectively, or who the church may not respond well to, because at the end of the day, we are trying to grow this kingdom in love and cooperation and unity. And so the church isn't trying to just throw people at a congregation that they think would not receive them well, because that would be horrible for both the congregation and the mental well-being of the pastor.
The only agenda the annual conference has is to make disciples of Jesus Christ for the transformation of the world. So that's what they're doing when they work together to make those appointments. Mm-hmm. It takes months for them to get all of those.
And it doesn't do any, sometimes churches do need to be pushed to maybe take a cross-racial appointment or a cross-gender appointment if a church hasn't ever had a female pastor. So the church always has say in the decision, but sometimes the conference, truly, they really want to marry the best candidate, the best clergy person to that congregation. So it would do the congregation a disservice to send someone that won't be embraced. And
but you also don't want to lean into confirmation bias as well, of like, let's send you someone who has all the same thoughts, ideas, feelings as you already have, because that's not really ripe for growth.
There's a lot that goes into it, and that's one of the beautiful things and the things I love about the United Methodist Church is nothing is done willy-nilly and nothing's done by one person. There's always layers and committees and prayer, and there's processes. Yes. And so there's all kinds. Yes, we are. There's methods. So it's always beyond just the bishop or just the district superintendent, just the pastor, just the SPRC, which is Staff Parish Relations Chair.
Mm-hmm. So with the marriages piece. So the language that required actionable offense for marrying same-sex couples has been removed. Mm-hmm. And so what I'm hearing is each individual local church, their leadership decides, are we going to be performing same-sex weddings? My guess is on a case-by-case basis. You don't need to make a blanket statement of, you know, we're never going to do it or we're always going to do it no matter what, because I feel like with marriages, you want to marry people who you think are a good match for each other, right?
And to that point, you mentioned that whether the weddings would happen, it's up to trustees or whatever board, whatever weddings happen at the church, but clergy, like you have alluded, you've done many weddings off campus. So it's up to the clergy for each case basis of whether they're going to marry those two individuals. And so now that removal of language, now that they're no longer can be charged for choosing to marry couples of the same gender, it's still up to the clergy individually.
Yeah. Well, and I think that a lot of our listeners who are members of this church wanna know, are you going to be performing same-sex marriages as individual clergy? And I feel like the answer is, let's get to know the couple. But
sure.
But like, again, this is a hard thing to make blanket statements around.
Absolutely. We've always been able to make our own decision. And I know all of our clergy here require premarital counseling sessions. I remember early in my ministry at Treach, I was asked to do to marry a couple that one was a different religion, not a Christian religion. And I had to really think and pray about that. And I met with them and their families to decide if that was something that I felt comfortable doing and why did they want to get married in a Christian church. So we've always had consultative processes. And so I'll just answer that question. It would depend. Mm-hmm. I've only ever been asked to do one same-sex wedding and I wasn't able to perform it. And they're some of my very, very best friends.
Yeah, I have many LGBTQ friends, and I've never been asked. And I suppose it's because they knew of the restrictions that had been formally placed on us. But I've never been asked, and I would say a very similar response to Karen. It will depend on these premarital sessions mm-hmm. and what that brings to the fore and all that kind of stuff. So,
well. That's the end of my book of discipline conversation. Unless y'all really, really want to get deeper into the conversation.
We quote it all the time here.
Everything we're going to talk about is from the book of discipline.
Yeah.
Every topic.
But I want to talk a little bit about the social principles. So Daniel already told us a little bit about the purpose of the social principles. And there are just a couple of things that I really wanted to hit from the social principles. One is also around human sexuality. And there has been some removed language from the social principles around sexuality and marriage, and there has been some new language added. So this is one of the things that they did adjust. The language that was removed said, "We do not condone the practice of homosexuality and consider this practice to be incompatible with Christian teaching." And so, as Daniel mentioned, I misspoke. That was added to social principles in 1972. The new language that is now in social principles under the marriage section is, "Within the church, we affirm marriage as a sacred lifelong covenant that brings two people of faith, an adult man and an adult woman, or two adult persons of consenting age, into union with one another." So it's a big deal for a lot of people because this is redefining what marriage is to the United Methodist Church. And I just want to get your initial reactions to the language that was removed and the language that was added.
Yeah. I would just say this, and then obviously anybody else. I have a love-hate relationship with the social principles. I absolutely love the concept of them. I agree with probably 95% of them, but I don't agree with all of the social principles. And that's the beauty of the United Methodist Church mm-hmm. because the social principles are not mandated. Mm-hmm. They are the official stance of the denomination for all of these topics. And whenever I talk about them, I say I challenge anybody to find a topic not covered in the social mm-hmm. principles. It's the economy, the ecology, economics, it's weather, it's sexuality, it's marriage, it's abortion, it's divorce. I mean, every topic imaginable is covered.
Stem cell research,
right?
Parenting. Yeah. I mean, we are picking one mm-hmm. issue out among, to your point, thousands of issues. Mm-hmm. And this is the one that's always on the front burner.
Yeah. Mm. But the social principles were designed to say, here's what we believe as United Methodist on these, what again, I will call non-essential issues. And I don't mean to say that they're unimportant,
right,
but they are not doctrinal. And so in our sort of defining ways, we say these are non-essential. So it is the church's stance, but unlike for instance, the Roman Catholic Church or the Orthodox Christianity or the Baptist Church or a few others, when they say this is our stance, they say you must believe it or you can't be a member of this denomination. We don't say that with regard to the social principles. Mm-hmm. And that's where I get into the hate part of the social principles, because they then have very little weight. They don't really have consequence, if you will. And so even though they are the stance of the denomination, even I or we as mm-hmm. ordained clergy don't have to either abide by them or profess affirmation of them.
Mm-hmm. Stepping away from human sexuality, some other big changes were made in the social principles, and it was mostly around creation care and recognizing that we're in trouble here.
Yes.
A lot of the language that was changed, you know, it's I'll link to an article that lays out everything that was changed in the show notes, so that if you're interested in reading through the social principles, you can. But there's a section called Community of All Creation. And in that section, they are like hitting it. They mm-hmm. say, we recognize that human activity has put God's creation in peril. We recognize the destruction of ecosystem with overconsumption, unsustainable practice. We recognize global warming in China and climate change. Jeez. Oh gosh. We recognize that global warming and climate change are threatening the entirety of life. We recognize that we must transition from fossil fuels. We recognize environmental racism and that exists. We recognize that we need to adopt sustainable policies and practices, food justice, caring for all creatures. And they even added in protecting space. The cosmos are also created by God, and we must protect them. They affirm science and traditional. I mean, it is heavy mm-hmm. creation care
yes.
that has been added. And it's across the heaviest is in that section, Community of All Creation, but it's across multiple sections. It's been added in the preamble. It's been added into so many different areas saying, hey, we got to be good stewards of this earth that we have been gifted, and we have to stop treating it like this is a resource for us to exploit. And I don't know what else to say about that. I mean, they
well, that's
went
as scriptural
hard.
As it comes. It tells us in Genesis that we have dominion, and most people use that dominion as translated to mean I can do anything I want, when in fact the Hebrew means we need to serve and protect God's created order. Mm-hmm. So it's as biblical as it gets.
Mm-hmm. So if y'all want to comb through all of those changes in the social principles, I will post it, but it is intense. And they're saying, hey, we are knocking on the end here if we don't make changes. Like, there's a lot of things that's like, we have to take immediate action.
I mean, I just think it just brings back to the forefront. What the social principles do is it gives a opportunity for it to come back into annual conferences and into local congregations to be, hey, look what the United Methodist Church says we believe about this. And it gives them an opportunity and a starting point to say, what are we going to do about this? How can we make something actionable out of it? So,
well, and my understanding of the social principles is that they change often. They're added to often, they're adjusted often. Yeah. This is not something that you're going to go 20 years and nothing's changed.
Right.
And a lot of the conversation is around context, the context of the time, the culture that you're living in. There will be changes. And just because it was true 60 years ago doesn't mean it's true today. And that kind of takes me into regionalization. And this is a really fun word for people. If people are still with us, they're the Metha nerds. They're
or it's my mom.
That's
my
the
mom.
Truth, yeah.
These are the people who are still with us right now are like, yeah, I'm into this Methodist thing. Let's talk regionalization.
Thanks y'all for sticking with it.
Yeah. Right. Mom, you can wake up now.
Yeah. So regionalization was one of the first big changes that came out of General Conference this year that got people really amped up. So can you give me an overview of what regionalization is and why it matters?
Well, basically, regionalization is an equitable issue about moving from a U.S.-centric denomination that is global to a more equitable denomination that is global. And it basically says all regions, if you will, of the world where United Methodism exists are going to be equal. And so U.S. will be a region, Africa will be a region, Philippines will be a region, Europe will be a region, and they'll have equal representation. And a part of what that means is that instead of getting so wrapped up in U.S. issues, everybody will be able to sort of focus on their concerns and their contextual ministries. And it's kind of a way to kick off colonialization, right? Because that's what had become true in the United Methodist Church, whether we wanted to own that or not. And so I was as much excited about this as any other thing that came up. And so I'm a Metho nerd, I guess. But but here's the other thing we need to realize is this is a constitutional change, whereas everything so far we've talked about has already taken effect. This simply got approved in order to change the constitution of the United Methodist Church, and therefore it requires an aggregate of 2/3 of every annual conference across the globe to approve it at their 2025 gatherings, and then it will be finalized if indeed that aggregate comes to fruition. It will be finalized at the special called General Conference of 2026. So this can't take shape for another 2 years, and it will only take shape if we get that aggregate 2/3 of all of the conferences.
Well, and the reason I was tying this into context is because a lot of the articles I've read around regionalization, everybody is excited about it. Yes. Everybody. And it really is the decolonization of the United Methodist Church, where this mentality of been like at past general conferences that are a worldwide event, the U.S. agenda has become the default.
Absolutely.
And then every other, you know, world region is kind of put on the back burner of correct. When we have time, right. We'll get to this, which is just so ridiculous and unfair. But also what this allows for is for each region to live into their context, yes. of yes. their place. Obviously, we're going to do things very different in the U.S. than they're going to do on the continent of Africa, and even Northern Africa versus Southern Africa. You know, it's going to be different.
Well, it's an exciting time because it was asked for by what are currently known as the Central Conferences, these other conferences, right? They're the ones who wanted it, and therefore it's a good thing because they now it will help them become much more contextualized in their ministry. And oh, by the way, the African continent will probably become, within a decade or so, the largest region of the United Methodist Church. And we just need to realize that.
I thought that they would potentially split off into like 3 or 4 different regions.
They could eventually, right?
Yeah.
But the other part that I just want to make sure people are clear about is, again, the doctrinal portion of the discipline will always remain the same across the globe. That will always remain because it is unchangeable. It's that back part of the Book of Discipline that we've referenced before that is procedural and operational, and those are the things that can change contextually and ought to. So that's, I get excited about that.
In America here, most likely the people listening to it are in America, but if you're not, that's really cool. It won't look different for us really, because everything has been pretty U.S. centric in the past. And so it will just allow people in other regions of the world to do ministry even more effectively.
I don't really know enough about regionalization to have any more questions because I'm not 100% like sure of what I'm even talking about here. I think it'll be interesting to see how this unfolds over time.
Yes.
And to Daniel's point, this is a constitutional change. So it has to be voted on again in 2 years. Next year.
Yeah, much like the U.S. Constitution, if there were an amendment made, right, all of the states have to ratify it.
Let's talk about changes for clergy. There's a new retirement plan for the pastors. I don't think that a lot of our listeners, unless you are a pastor,
I don't really care about it.
Exactly.
I'm going to skip over that.
I'm on the downhill slide here, you know.
Yeah, and I want to talk about changes for deacons. So we have two deacons here at Treach, Reverend Karen Kraska and Reverend Doug Meyer. And a change that has been made is that deacons are now able to conduct baptisms and communion. And this has always been a big mystery to me of why deacons could not do this prior. So does anyone know like the history of, I guess our deacon among us could answer the question. Why weren't deacons able to perform baptism?
Sacramental authority is probably the term you're looking for.
Oh, thank you.
Just, I mean, administer sacraments.
Right. Because that just rolls off the tongue.
Right.
What is the difference between a deacon and elder, Karen?
Well, when I first came into ministry, we had two different, deacons were probationary members to becoming an elder. And then back in, golly, you're going to make me remember, was it 1996. When that changed, some of our polity changed, and deacons became an order unto themselves. So there's ordained elders that are ordained to word, sacrament, and order. And then the deacon in full connection, which is what Doug and I are, were love, justice, and service. And so we were called to assist with our two sacraments in the United Methodist Church, Holy Communion and Baptism. We could do weddings and funerals because in the United Methodist Church, those are not sacraments, but we were to assist with the sacraments. Now, because of General Conference, that language has been removed, and we can now perform those sacraments.
Well, how is that something that's exciting to you?
Oh, or? I think it's really in the best interest of the church. I think that because there was a new order formed, there was a lot of discussion when I went through the process of a deacon is basically a specialist, so to speak. It's like a general practitioner doctor and a specialization. So many deacons have a certification, like mine is in music. You can have certifications in youth ministry or senior adult ministry or business and finance or missions. So a lot of deacons that are functioning have a specialization. Now that we have churches, well, I guess we always have, but I know a lot of deacons that function as the solo pastor because of either a shortage of clergy or rural areas. And it's very difficult in those settings for a deacon because if we do communion once a month, which is pretty typical in our United Methodist churches, deacons have had to get a special permission from the bishop in order to perform the sacraments. And if you're the solo pastor, that's pretty important. In a setting like ours, where we have two ordained elders, it's not been so much of an issue. However, we have been asked on youth mission trips or choir tours or at the end of a Bible study when the class wants to have communion. I've been asked many, many times, and we've had to do what we call a love feast where we say prayers and we do a blessing, but it's not the words of institution that the elders have been the ones to say. So it really is, I don't know the word I'm looking for, but no, I'm very excited. I'm very excited to have that permission. I did not feel when I went through the process that was the crux of my ministry. I didn't feel like God called me into ministry so I could administer the sacraments or order the life of the church. I felt very clear that my giftedness and my calling was through music and worship and the arts. Now, like anything else, you go and you grow and you learn and God kind of equips you and calls you to things that when you start a journey, you can't necessarily see around the corner, which is a good thing. So I feel very comfortable now. Many years ago, I would have been like, because I kind of believed and was fine with, okay, this is just a different order that I'm a part of.
Well, and help me understand. This is, I'm Wild West over here. Why is sacramental authority a thing even? Because I've had so many times I've been at a retreat or I've been in a small group and the thought is, let's take communion. Okay. Like we know the words, we have right. The elements, like someone can say a prayer right. over it. Like why is sacramental authority even important?
I think that's rules that we've made.
Yeah, so it ties to our Catholic background, mm-hmm. to be perfectly blunt, yes. right? We are two kissing cousins separate from the Catholic Church. And mm-hmm. so there are many Christian denominations and or independent churches for which sacramental authority is not an issue at all. Individual members of churches baptize their friends, or committee folks consecrate the elements for communion. So it's not just a United Methodist thing, but it stems from our relationship with the Catholic Church that said sacramental authority comes from the apostolic succession. And it's why, as a, for instance, if you really want to become metho nerds, why we struggled with ordaining women for a long time, because there was a belief that they couldn't have been a part of the apostolic succession, and why in the Catholic Church they still don't do it, right? I mean, that's deep into the weeds. Finally, we got over that and just realized that what we wanted to claim as United Methodist followers was that the ordained elders were the ones who were given sacramental authority. And so really, as Karen already mentioned, deacons actually had the possibility for sacramental authority, but with special permission from the bishops. And at some point in our time over the last 15 years or so, for some reason, it must have been an agreement at a Council of Bishops meeting, they started getting real stingy with offering that permission. But it had to do with our polity, right? Our structure was, we have two different orders, deacons and elders. And she delineated the differences, and some of those differences were about itinerancy for elders and non-itinerancy for deacons. One was sacramental authority for elders and not for deacons, and the other was about what those orders do. And so now we're sort of, instead of having greater clarity about these, we're bringing them closer together and may actually end up where she and I were at the beginning, because when we first started in ministry— you started as a deacon, and that was the probationary portion, and then you became an elder. Mm-hmm. Now, for the last almost 30 years, they're just two different orders.
Mm-hmm. All right, our very last topic, budget.
So, there's money involved. All I know.
Yeah. This is the cue for a lot of people that are just going to turn it
for
off.
For some
now.
People... For some people, this is a really big thing. And for some people, they are like, who cares? But the first thing I want to talk about is changes to apportionments. Could you give us a little, like, what is an apportionment? Let's define what that is and the changes that are happening.
So I think one, maybe... to put it in layman's terms, it's almost like taxes to the annual conference. That the local church, that each
it's
local church.
It's a franchise fee. It's not a tax. It's a franchise fee.
Render to Caesar what is Caesar's.
Right, right. I mean, essentially, yeah. But every local church pays into the annual conference, which is the smallest governing body of the United Methodist Church. They pay into that based on their membership. And it's to keep programs running. It's for, all kinds of things.
Like, can you give me some examples of where this money goes?
Well, like the conference offices is what I'm thinking of.
Missions.
Missions thing. Gosh, the North Texas Conference has a center for leadership development, has a center for mission outreach. That's not what it's called, though.
It is.
It is?
Missional Outreach.
Oh, yeah. Missional Outreach.
It's combined
yes.
with the assistant to the bishop.
Okay. And
some
others.
Salaries. And some salaries.
And salaries.
Yeah. Yeah, so it goes to the conference level, even jurisdictional level, which is this mid-grade part, and then to the general conference for things like Episcopal Fund to pay for our bishops, the agencies of the United Methodist Church, mission sending agencies, for instance. And so it goes for all of those things that create a larger witness for the faith.
It keeps the whole thing running.
Okay. Well, because what
so
I...
So they say.
What I read... Well, I mean...
Or it's supposed to.
My hope, which I guess I didn't know about where apportionments go, but like my hope is, okay, we're all pooling our resources together and it funds things like UMCOR or like that, but also can it go back to churches to help struggling churches?
Absolutely.
Like, is that, okay.
Absolutely.
It does. I was like,
I just didn't like the thought of it all going to
administration
costs. No.
It goes there and then it funnels into all kinds of different.
Okay. Yeah. So what I read about the decisions being made to apportionments is that they're actually being reduced. And I don't know the exact percentage, but it's something like one percentage point lower than it was after the previous conference. And I'm a little bit confused by that because I also saw that like we're decreasing our budgets pretty dramatically. And so what I don't understand is if we're decreasing our budgets across the board and also decreasing apportionments, are we tightening our belts or what are we doing here?
Well, so again, when you hear, for instance, that the budget is 40% lower than it was in 2016, of course, that's an aggregate amount that's coming from all these local churches from across the globe to help make the general church run. That can obviously be distributed out across those churches. And that's why this, I think it's the 2.9%. That's just the general conference portion of the budget. Of apportionments, because at the local church level, your apportionments are predominantly going to the annual conference, and then in this case, only like 2.9% going to the general church.
Okay.
So that's why, because they're distributed differently.
So does this mean that our amount going towards apportionments for this church is going to go down, so we'll have more money to work with, or is it going to all come out even in the end?
Our apportionment, so annual apportionments, apportionment dollars, rather, are determined in two ways. One is the general conference way, the 2.9%, and then the annual conference sets an amount as well. And our formula for 2025 has been changed in the North Texas Annual Conference to be reduced by 10% across the board, so that all churches in the North Texas Conference will pay 10% less than what they were paying last year.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, that's a lot. Woo-hoo. That's a lot of money to work with.
Sure.
So does that mean that we'll get to use that money more to pour into the community locally?
Yes.
Okay. Fantastic. Yes. So with that big decrease in budget, I mean, that was kind of shocking for me to hear. And I know that with the disaffiliation process that's been happening, we have a lot fewer churches than we had in the previous general conference. But 40% lower budget than 2016 feels like we're really, really tightening the belt here. Do you know how that will affect the United Methodist Church within the United States? You mentioned general agencies.
Yeah,
what are those?
Well, things like the General Board of Global Ministries, which is our mission sending organization, or the General Board of Discipleship, which is kind of how we discover how we grow spiritually. And then COSRO, Commission on, help me out because I always forget acronyms, but women.
Commission, yeah. Race and... Right. I don't remember.
The various, those agencies. So the attempt, the 40% reduction is a twofold deal. One is, so we lost roughly 25% of our churches. So
yes.
You can just start off with, well, we probably better go down by about 25%, right? And then the other is an intentional effort to say, we have too much bureaucracy. We are too top heavy.
I know there were a lot of acronyms in there that
sounds like bureaucracy.
Yeah. Yeah. And so the 40% is a serious cut because we see the writing on the wall that number one, we've lost some churches, but number two, we have needed this for a long time. There was an effort, for instance, in 2012, so, you know, 12 years ago, to do this kind of budget cutting, and it got nixed. It got voted in, and then it got abolished by the Judicial Council. We won't go into all of that, but that was an attempt 12 years ago to do this thing, and now we have to do this thing in terms of finances because we know we're too top-heavy.
Yeah. Well, and so I saw part of that is they are reducing the number of bishops worldwide, but also in the United States. And I was just wondering, I know recently we were part of the North Texas Conference and they've combined us with the Central Conference. Is that a result of fewer bishops? And so one bishop is overseeing both conferences?
Yeah, actually right now our bishop is assigned to both the North Texas Conference and the Central Texas Conference. And the goal is actually not only to combine these two, but add the what was formerly known as the Northwest Texas Conference. None of this has happened yet. It's to be voted on at these annual conferences this year and then to be affirmed at the jurisdictional conference and then implemented, I guess, in 2025. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that hasn't happened. But its goal is to reach this, as you say, sort of to bring us together with fewer bishops overseeing more annual conferences.
Okay. We covered a lot of information, yeah, right? Okay. 5 out of the 1,000 petitions we covered. And I would love to hear from each of you, everything that we just talked about. How do you see this leading us into the future of the United Methodist Church?
I am very hopeful. I am very optimistic. And I believe that, to Daniel's point, we were a top-heavy church. We knew it. It's a behemoth, the United Methodist Church, globally. And just like in a family, just like in a school system, you know, there are things that need to change. You have to pivot. You have to evaluate your budget, your finances, your values, your priorities. And I'm very proud of the United Methodist, because as large of an institutional church as the United Methodist Church is, I believe, because I've been a part of leadership at different levels, it's grounded in faith and integrity. And that doesn't mean that there aren't things that we've done that we regret. But the United Methodist Church will turn. We're kind of like the Titanic. We may turn slowly, but it's that's a bad analogy. Not the Titanic. Not the Titanic. A large ship cannot turn slowly. Scratch the Titanic. We're not sinking. I think we're now poised for phenomenal growth. I think we're going to witness in a better, more robust, culturally, with new cultural context, and I'm very excited. I am very excited and feel like this is a just a new day in the Methodist Church.
Well, this is the beginning of my ministry, and so I've kind of seen this road ahead as I've gone through this ordination process. At every single interview, it's been like, why now? Why, you know, this is an interesting time to be part of the United Methodist Church. And you know, for me personally, it was just, well, I just know this is what God is calling me to do, and whatever that will look like, I'm just going to try to be faithful to my calling and what God is calling me to. And I am very hopeful that, the United Methodist Church, it's given me hope that they've made decisions.
Yes.
Instead of, it felt like they were treading water for so long. And so it's made me hopeful. I mean, I get apprehensive about any kind of change, whether it's good or bad, just because I don't know what it's going to look like. So I definitely, you know, what I thought my future could look like now could be very different, but I am hopeful that it is for the good of the world, that is good for the people of God. So that's what I'm holding on to.
Yeah, indeed. I would use the word hopeful as well versus excited. I'm not saying that I'm not excited, but I'm hopeful. And I'm hopeful on two levels. One was, I've never been to General Conference as Karen has, but I'm told by those who have attended many General Conferences, this one had a deeper sense of the Holy Spirit, a deeper sense of unity, and a deeper sense of purposefulness of mission than any they had been a part of. That's hopeful to me. And then secondly, as I sort of started off with, we now can get off dead center and stop wasting time.
Yes.
And that's what I get hopeful about is, man, we can stop treading water and we can start doing what God has equipped us and called us to do. And that part is exciting, but it's also hopeful.
Well, thank y'all so much for contributing to this conversation. And man, again, I'm very happy to be United Methodist.
Amen.
The Life Plus God podcast is hosted, written, and produced by me, Alyssa Robinson, and sponsored by Treach Memorial United Methodist Church in Flower Mound, Texas. Check out Treach online at tmumc.org or in person to see if this church is a right fit for you and your family. We'd love for you to visit us soon. And if you like the podcast, don't forget to subscribe and rate us on your podcast platform to help other people find our content. Join us next week and let's keep growing in relationship with Christ together.